With our fascinating guest tonight, Alan Greenfield, and we're talking about his latest work, Angel Spells, but his dabbling in the occult. So we're going to come back, talk more, take some calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Alan Greenfield, with us. Alan, with all these things that you've done in your career, do these strange occurrences just come at you? Do you conjure things up? I mean, what happens in a day in the life of Alan Greenfield?
Well, it can be both, and there are occasions, usually once a month, where I get together with other people of similar interest and level of interest, and we do working. So we are deliberately doing manifesting some form of magic, whether it be healing or conjuration or whatever. Sometimes we get weird interference, like a couple of times we've been buzzed by large black helicopters with no markings on them. But other than that, it's what we're there to do, and we do it, and have had nothing but good results for many years. There was a time, same location. Atlanta has expanded enormously over the last 20, 30 years.
Oh, it sure has. Huge. Airport's huge.
Yeah, well, they give you an idea of how remote this area where Arabia Mountain is, what we call our power spot. The Roman Catholic Monastery is there because I guess when they built it, they thought they were getting away from civilization. Huh. Now it's pretty civilized.
Little did they know.
Yes, we've been going out there since 1980 when it was still very wild and woolly. The mountain itself is still pretty much, we have it to ourselves. But the locals in the little towns around there began to have a rumor that the overnights that we did, we would build a bonfire and do our dreamtime walk. That was sort of the approach that we took in the back in those days, and we began to hear that there was a group of Satanists on the mountain at the same time, because we went up on equinoxes and solstices. So we started looking for the Satanists. We thought, well, you know, if we're out here, let's see, you know, what they're actually up to.
What were you going to do with them if you found them?
Well, I didn't. We didn't get that far in our thinking. But what happened was, after a couple of successive efforts to find them, we realized that what the locals were taking for Satanists were us. It's like Winnie the Pooh and the Woozle, you know. We were chasing ourselves. Apparently they saw the bonfire and saw us in the shadows on the mountain, and being, you know, very rural southern people, which I have no room to talk. I'm a rural southern person myself. But nevertheless, they thought we were, you know, them. So there were no Satanists. They were just us folks. All nice people.
You were the Satanist.
Apparently so. We never found anybody else out there. Nobody went out there. And then they changed the local rules. They did. They closed the mountain at night. I always think when they close a canyon or a mountain, I sort of have this image of a wall coming down. You can't close it, but they will bark at you, and now they will. So we do our stuff in the daytime now, and I don't think the satanic rumors are around anymore. Although it wasn't help, the Pet Cemetery movies were filmed on this mountain. So
those were freaky movies too.
Yes, well, that's because the mountain is a very freaky place.
Yeah, I guess so. We're going to get to your calls here in a second, Alan, as they line up to chat with you. What has been the strangest occurrence that's happened to you when you've been doing this?
Wow, that's a tough question. The strangest occurrence.
I'm sure you've had one.
Oh, there's more than one. It's like picking the best. The strangest is probably something that doesn't sound that strange, except to live it. I used to, I'm sort of athletic, and I do 2 miles on the bicycle every day and then walk for 2 miles. And I used to do the walk in the middle of the night because, you know, you avoid traffic and having to deal with people making turns into you and so forth. And every night I would pass this, in the darkest part of the places that I went, and I went the same route all the time, I saw what appeared to be a cat, and when I got closer, it was a piece of, I guess, cellophane or some kind of debris that somehow never got moved. And I passed it, and I thought, well, this is interesting. Why am I seeing a cat on this piece of debris? Because it doesn't look like a cat. And as soon as I get, you know, just within the range of vision where I could resolve it, clearly it's just a piece of paper, not a cat running away or anything like that. No cat there. One night, I see the cat. I'm not thinking anything of it. I get closer, and there's a cat sitting on this piece of cellophane. Never before and never again. And that was during the period when I was writing a great deal about the illusory nature of reality and how we build it up out of essentially a biocentric universe. Our own senses build up the universe outside of ourselves. And I thought, well, apparently I've manifested this cat. Now, that wasn't the biggest thing that ever happened to me, but it was the one that hit home that that your imagination can become real. It's why I've often said to the dismay of a lot of ufologists that the UFO investigators are part of the phenomena because they become deeply embedded in it, people like Kiel and Mosley and so forth, and notice I talk about people who are safely dead. And the phenomena begins to bend itself around people's preconceptions about it, as if reality were, in a sense, plastic, and was molding itself to the individual's expectations.
Okay, let's go take some calls here for you. Let's go to Mark in Montreal, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for calling. You're on the air with us.
Hey, good morning, George, and good morning, Alan. And George, I was talking to Tom. He says you were thinking of coming to Montreal to do some lectures.
I would love to. I have not been to Montreal, and I've got some relatives there, but I haven't been to Montreal since the Expo in the 60s.
Oh, my God, George, the place has changed.
I bet.
The place has changed. What I want to say, okay, look, at in 1976, okay, it was in the summer of 1976 in Montreal North, all right, I walked outside to go to the corner store. It was about 9 o'clock at night, and there was a UFO over my house. Over my house with amber lights turning, just to say. And this thing, I was on the sidewalk, I freaked out. And for that moment, there was no cars passing by. There was nobody, like everything locked in time there. And it was following me around for about a minute or two. And it just tilted upwards, and it just shot off into the stars. And at about 3 months later, George, 3 or 4 months later, and I'm not joking now, I'm sleeping. I wake up during the night, and I could hear something unscrewing my light bulb in my room. And I was, like, terrified, okay? And my father had given me a Parker pen, a silver Parker pen, all right, for school. And when I got up in the morning, George, I was freaked out. My Parker pen was gone, and I never found it since.
Huh.
Never found it since. I don't know if it was them that came to take out the piece of property from my house or whatever, but it was freaky, George. And I told people about that, about the UFO, and they go, oh, come on, it had to be a helicopter.
Right.
It was not that, George. It made no sound. It was there with amber lights turning very slowly, and it just, like, shot off in the stars.
I love that story. Hey, thanks for sharing that with us. Alan, when people come to you with these stories, in the beginning, years ago, did you believe them? Because I sense you believe them more now.
Well, in the beginning, I thought they had to be one of two things, as most nuts and bolts ufologists think. either their misapprehensions, like he was saying, people were telling him it was a helicopter or something. It's the follow-ups, like he's describing, apparition-type phenomena, a poltergeist-type activity, or visitations from, quote, the men in black, unquote, that happen afterwards that convince me that even the lights in the sky-type phenomena seen under certain circumstances, if you do follow-up, you become convinced that the false dichotomy of either spaceships from Mars, and they used to say Mars, and now we're the spaceships on Mars, or they say from other solar systems now, whatever, or that they are natural phenomena misapprehended or hoaxes or whatever, that gives way when you have paranormal phenomena almost invariably following any really good UFO sighting. It's predictable, just as I believe UFO sightings themselves are predictable. In fact, if you get to the back of Angel Spells, I give my particular method for predicting when UFO cases will happen. And I'm not going to make a prediction. I'm going to say, read that part of the book and do it yourself, and it's self-proving. But I thought that it was one or the other. Now I think it's neither of those two things. It's a hybrid. It's some sort of penetration from otherwhere. Jacques Vallée called it Magonia, which is just a way of saying fairyland. Something that is very, very close to our reality that periodically breaks through, and our five senses, of course, are built to, for relatively limited uses, you know, just to keep us from getting hit by cars and not getting eaten by saber-toothed tigers. That's the way we have evolved. They're not meant to see beings from other dimensions, if you will. And we see things somewhat as our receptors interpret them. But the fact that without any kind of prodding, a gentleman sees a UFO pretty close, I gather, from his description, and it's a very typical sighting. I mean, I'm not in any way diminishing it. I'm just saying I hear stories like that literally every day. And then has something really unusual, much more up close and personal happen that resembles a poltergeist case. You have to say the two, first of all, are probably linked, and secondly, that something is going on that covers both of these types of events. And that gets into a much, much broader area than isolating ufology from the occult, from yetis, from the abominable snowman, whatever, you know, particular area you want to get into. There seem to be manifestations that have a linkage amongst them that we normally don't get because we continue to address this false dichotomy of they're either spaceships from out, you know, planet P, or they're misidentified natural phenomena. That's just not the range of possibilities. It's much, much more complex than that.
How do you explain, Alan, the fact that this happens, that the unusual, the paranormal, the strange, that it happens? Why?
How does it happen? I think that we're always, remember my cat story, okay?
Yeah.
I think that we're all, it's a little story, but it was a big revelation to me. I think that we're always on the edge of otherwhere. There was a line in one of my favorite episodes of The X-Files where Mulder says, I think the dead are around us everywhere. And I think that otherwhere, the denizens of otherwhere, are around us at all times, but occasionally something, some event, some circumstance, something that we do, something that we do deliberately, something that just a change in our life, something like a near-death experience, for example, something opens up a window in our minds that allows us to see, hear, touch, smell, taste that otherness in one form or another or in multiple forms. And then for a brief time for most people, fortunately, for a brief time, we're seeing reality as it really is, which is a much more complex universe than we see on a day-to-day basis, or probably even want to see.
Isn't that
a satisfactory answer?
Yeah, I think so. Now, you wrote another book with Tim, going concurrent with the Angel Spells, called The Complete Rite of Memphis.
Tim didn't have anything to do with that one, but I did write it at the same time.
What's that about?
It's about the borders of the what I consider the core of the authentic tradition, going back to the first contacts between human beings and, you can call them aliens, but I would say non-human beings, carried forward into modern times through various occult and Freemasonic and other groups, often without comprehending what they're actually about. In The Complete Rite of Memphis, and be sure, if you get it, get the revised edition, because it has a lot more material in it, and it also is a lot less expensive. The old edition is now is selling for several hundred dollars, and this is a $20 book from Amazon. But it details the relationship between secret societies and the phenomena that they hold secret, which is the connection to what's sometimes referred to as the Sirius mystery, the notion of a single visitation in ancient times that brought civilization to Earth by something mm-hmm. or someone called the Ioannis or Giannis, or actually the English translation would be John.
That's a great story, too.
There are variations of the story with all of the oldest civilizations in the world, which I think is itself validating.
All pointing to the same place.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I find fascinating.
Yes.
It's almost like religions. They all believe in God, but they don't get along on anything.
Well, they don't all believe in God. I mean, the Buddhists are non-theistic, not anti-theistic, but non-theistic. But nevertheless, I think that, the English word God certainly doesn't convey... I'm pretty literate in biblical Hebrew. I'm not all that good with modern Hebrew because it's spoken very fast. Sort of like Spanish, it's very fast and it has a lot of abbreviations in it. But it's very interesting that in the original, there is only one place where God, and again, that's a Germanic word, Gott,
it's a huge word. Alan, we'll come back and talk more about this and wrap it up with some final calls. On our next Coast to Ghost program, we're going to be talking about the deaths of Marilyn Monroe, Princess Diana, Whitney Houston. You don't want to miss that. We're going to come back in a moment with Alan Greenfield. We'll take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, North Carolina we go. Simi, welcome to the show, Simi.
Good morning, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
And good morning, Alan. Thank you for sharing all your information. I'm wondering if you could shed your light on the background of Aleister Crowley and Otto and Jack Parsons. The reason I'm asking this is I've been doing some research over by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and the Arroyo Seco and Devil's Gate, where Jack Parsons used to go in with his friends and do all of his rocket fuel experimentations and explosions and so forth out there. But the more I've been reading about him and I guess his sorcery or conjuring up entities and beings, I was wondering what that was about, and about this entity that they call LAM, L-A-M, that Crowley and the Beast and Jack Parsons, the Antichrist, were working on. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I know probably too much about that, but I'd be glad to give you the brief answer.
The Cliff Note version, huh?
The Cliff Note version. In 1946, Jack Parsons, in addition to being a rocket scientist, was also the master of a lodge of the same organization that I didn't mention the name of, that I used to be an official of. And he and the founder of Scientology, I have to be very careful with this one, and a woman named Cameron, who had a certain fame of her own, engaged in an experiment in 1946 designed to open a portal to otherwhere. It was a months-long experiment. It concluded exactly 9 months to the day before I was born, on the opposite coast, I must add. It was in San Diego. They never closed the portal. Crowley was furious about it. He was the titular head of said organization, and Hubbard ran off with the girl, and that left Parsons in a sort of difficult situation. And a few years later, he was experimenting with rocket fuel and mysteriously blew up. There's a crater on the moon named after him, and he is one of the pioneers of American rocketry, but he was also a pioneer of bringing that particular form of occultism to the United States. The key thing to know, the Cliff Notes version, is they opened a door and a lot of things came through.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yes, it is, and no one has closed it to date. Somebody give me a ticket to San Diego and back, I'll close it.
Did you ever play around with a Ouija board?
Yeah. In fact, there's a very interesting story about Ouija boards that they're actually having a Ouija board conference this year, which I think is an
really
interesting thing. And unknown to most people, Aleister Crowley, a lot of the the young lady that was on the phone mentioned Lamb, which was one of Crowley's non-terrestrial contacts that he drew a picture of, and it foreshadowed the gray aliens. Looks very much like it. Many of the experiments that he did that seem paradoxical apparently were done on Ouija boards. My only experimental work with it was with my eldest son, who is very skeptical about these things, although he's a screenwriter and writes very dark movies, but good. But,
where is he? Is he out here in L.A.?
Not at the moment. He was, and he's on the East Coast right now, and with the winter they're having, he's threatening to move back to Hollywood. So. But he's a writer, not a not an actor. So, and he doesn't like me to plug his movies, so I'm not going to. But he says it's not professional to do that. Sorry, Alex. But in any case, where was I? I could, sort of got lost in the sidetrack there. Lamb and those experiments that Crowley did that were so puzzling, never mention it, but apparently were done using a Ouija board. So I was experimenting with that with my son, and I asked him a question that no one in the room, including him, he was only like 7 or 8 years old, knew the answer to, but that my mother, I could call, would know the answer to. Something involving family. And he was operating the board with his mother, and it spelled out the correct word, but I didn't know it. I just wrote it down. I called my mother, and I said, is so-and-so the, you know, whatever the particulars were, and it was exactly right. And I thought this was really weird. And it was something that pertained to my father, who had been deceased since before he was born, and my son has grown up to be this spitting image of my father at the same age, and that is even in mannerisms, and that's pretty weird.
Well, that happens too.
Yeah, but having knowledge, supposedly, you know, your genes don't carry knowledge information. It just carries general characteristics. This was a specific name of a family member that I had no idea of, and my mother would know because of the nature of my mother. I grew up with my mother's family in central Georgia, and hardly know my father's family, which is from Baltimore. So I do genealogical stuff on it now, but at the time I had no notion about this, and he spelled it out correctly, and it was an obscure question that my mother, you know, right like that, had the answer to, but my son would have had not direct knowledge of. So I thought that was very interesting. I haven't pursued Ouija stuff simply because there are so many people that do that, and I prefer direct trance channeling. That's a much more productive route, and it's done by one person, so it doesn't, you know, it either rings true or it doesn't ring true. If you have two people working it, it's always the question of, is one of the people manipulating the board? If I'm doing it myself, I know that it's me, you know. So.
All right, good. Let's go to Alaska. Derek's with us. Hello, Derek. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm anxious to talk to you. So much of what you're saying is ringing true with me. I've led an extensive life. I've lived in Boston, Savannah, San Luis Valley in Colorado, as well as Newport Richey, which you also mentioned earlier on. And from my earliest memories, the occult to me is ESP. It's extrasensory perception. It's being open to the notion of other things. And I feel that most people have this within them. It's ingrained in us. But when we go to our quote-unquote adult professional lives, we negate that. We forget about that part of us. And I was wondering what the one crucial thing is. Like, I know what it would take for me to refocus myself to get some of the insight that I used to gain as a young child when my imagination was wild. But as an adult, what might you say would be the one way to re-harness that or focus it and not, how to redevelop that, I guess, is what I'm asking you. What would you say with your knowledge and your experience and your...
You need to do a lot of unlearning. As you mature, you tend to take on a lot of the baggage of the everyday world. Now, some of that is very useful information. You know, it gets down to, do you look both ways when you cross the street? But a lot of it is just baggage. And the best way and the quickest way out that I know of is to do jhana or zen or sitting meditation. You don't have to have any belief system involved with that. Just learn to do it. A biofeedback device would be helpful with that to get yourself into an alpha receptive state where you are in a state of being mentally acutely aware but not focused on any particular thought. And you are essentially, for that period of time, the longer you can stay in that meditative state, you are letting in the otherness that what you're calling ESP, and I think that's a correct way of putting it. I think the occult is directed psychic phenomena or ESP or paranormal phenomena, whatever you want to call it. The name is not important. The point is, at some period of having that internal silence with awareness, that quality that you started out your life with will return to you, and you can develop it from there. But I would recommend... looking at Alan Watts' work, the late Alan Watts was marvelous on the art of meditation, without any of the baggage of the spiritual associations that you might or might not be interested in.
And is there a balance that can be achieved with sustaining, you know, the family and the bills and all that stuff, but still achieving that awareness.
It's worked pretty well for me, and I know other people who it works pretty well for. I haven't, you know, made a fortune, or, and I don't own an island, and I don't have a harem, or, you know, but in all seriousness, yes, you can strike a balance. That's why I recommend something like meditation. You really only need, once you start it, you only really need about a half an hour out of your day, and then you go back to your daily activities. In fact, even if you develop these things, I recommend doing something very mundane for a goodly portion of your day. Otherwise, you become so otherworldly that you forget to look both ways when you cross the street. You have to strike a balance, and I would recommend the Book of the Balance, which you can find in many places on the internet. Reading that is very helpful in keeping that sense of balance between the material world and the supersensory realm.
Alan, do you miss the national UFO conferences?
Oh, yes, I do. And this summer, some of us that were the team ufologists that organized the thing way back in 1964, one of our number died unexpectedly at in his early 60s. He had been ill for a very long time, although he accomplished a lot with his life. And the rest of us kind of got together, and we decided to have a reunion this June where it all started in Cleveland, Ohio. And we've invited younger folks that are interested in ufology and UFOs to show up there. There's no charge or anything. I mean, if you get there, that's, you know, your...
Yeah,
we're going to have a reunion, and we'll see how that goes.
All right,
curiously, my high school reunion is this year as well. So
you got to go to that.
I sort of dread seeing some of these people because, as I'm sure you realize, I still look young and handsome.
Of course you do.
All the others have aged, but that's, you know.
That's because ETs have done some work with you.
Well, that's because I spent 10 years doing youth magic, and then I realized that's all I was doing, so.
Let's go to Mark in McMinnville.
Oh,
welcome
my.
To the program. There you go, Mark.
Hey, good morning, George. I love your guest, and God bless you both.
Thank you. Mark, go ahead.
Hey, God bless you both. I'm glad to hear from you finally. I'm loving this program. I want to hear from you guys.
Well, God bless you too, sir. And you're living in McMinnville, Oregon?
Yes, he is.
Sighting of one of the best UFO sightings of all times, and possibly the best still photo case of all time, the Trent case. Made Life magazine back when that was a big deal. I still have a copy of that from the early 1950s.
I think Mark's the one who sent the Mother Mary pictures.
Ah.
Maybe so. Let's go to Rock Hills, North Carolina. Barry, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hello, George. What a pleasure it is again to speak from South Carolina. No big deal. I'm 5 miles from North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
How are you, buddy?
Wonderful.
Well, listen, I got a great little story. We're almost out of time. My wife and I live here in Rock Hill, and we go up to the Blue Ridge Parkway every fall. And believe it up there, we missed the fall this year, George, but we were up there about 3 weeks ago, and your guest mentioned the Brown Mountain Light, which runs on Highway 181 between Morganton, North Carolina, and the Blue Ridge Parkway.
That's right.
Sure does.
Listen to this, George. We pulled into the pull-off, and we're looking around. We've never seen any lights because it's always been daylight. But guess who was there?
I would guess Joshua P. Warren.
Joshua P. Warren.
Yep, he's right out that way.
He's in Asheville, less than an hour
away.
That's
right. Exactly.
And I've heard him talk about it, and there was already about a dozen people there. And then I noticed a group, and I eased over there, and I said, "Are you Joshua P. Warren?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I listen to you on Coast to Coast all the time."
He's a great guy.
He lit up with a smile and told the people what was going on. And, you know, he was just giving a tour. And then my wife just drove him up to the parkway. And we love to go in the wintertime, George. There's absolutely no leaves on the trees. It looks like thousands and thousands of skeletons.
And nice and crispy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we got a convertible, and we didn't even bother to put the top down.
No, I don't blame you. Hey, we've got a minute left here, Alan. I want to thank you for being on the program, first and foremost. Would you give out your website, your Facebook site for people?
You know, I've gotten around to deciding the best way to get in touch with me. I've been on the Internet since it was the ARPANET. So just Google my name, Alan, A-L-L-E-N, Greenfield, G-R-E-E-N-F-I-E-L-D, and you'll come up with thousands of entries on me, including my Facebook page and my old blog and my new blog and my live journal and all those other things that I've done or am doing. And buy my books from Amazon, Angel Spells and Complete Rite of Memphis, and you'll be very happy with them, I hope.
Keep chasing.
Give them a bad review. That's
you got it. Keep chasing the paranormal, Alan, all right?
I'll do that.
Alan Greenfield is a great guest, talking about, of course, the occult and the very strange. Don't forget our next Coast to Coast program as we talk about the strange deaths of Marilyn Monroe, Princess Diana, and I've been told Whitney Houston, too. So we'll talk about that. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.